intentionally communicating, so now they chomp their teeth, they huff, they swat, they false charge, they make a guttural sound.
They are black bears, and they're as much a part of New Hampshire as fall foliage and stone walls. And yet, for all that, they are a misunderstood species. I'm Dave Anderson from the Forest Society, and this is Something Wild. To better understand the species, we wanted to talk to a bear. The closest thing we could get was Ben Killam, and that's pretty close, which is evident when you meet him. He's over 6 feet tall and moves with a slow, ambling gait. His earth sign tendencies aren't surprising when you consider Killam's been studying and living with black bears for nearly 25 years. I visited with him recently at the Killam Black Bear Rehabilitation Center in Lyme, New Hampshire.
Well, the center consists of, as we walk over here, you'll see a building, which is the indoor enclosure. And then it's attached to an 8-acre forested enclosure, which consists of a high tensile electric fence with a plastic deer fence clipped to it.
He founded the center with his sister Phoebe, and together they have taken in, rehabilitated, and released about 130 orphan cubs over the years. Not all the cubs Killam has rehabbed were actually orphans. Some were abandoned. I asked him how these cubs end up at his facility.
Well, there's all kinds of things. Some are natural, like cub abandonment. First-time moms and mothers that don't put on enough fat will give birth to cubs. And when they run out of milk, they automatically come into estrus and attract males. So they either run off and leave the cubs or expose them to the males. The biggest cause has been mothers getting shot at chicken coops. And these are unprotected chicken coops.
You can easily protect your chicken coop with
a simple electric fence with bait on it. And by bait, I mean peanut butter or bacon grease rubbed on the wire. Bears check out all new smells with their tongue. And once they've been zapped on the tongue, they have very little interest in what's behind the fence.
An electric fence protects the chickens and the bears. Another way to protect bears has to do with that clear plastic tube in your backyard filled with sunflower seeds. Bird feeders are where most of us are likely to encounter a black bear. So one of the questions that comes up is, when can I put my bird feeders out again?
Well, traditionally it's safe after Thanksgiving to put your bird feeders out and bring them in around April 1st when the snow's gone. Mm-hmm.
Because that's the time of scarcity when most bears are indeed denned up for the winter.
That's correct.
So it sounds like that the male bears, you said, they can have a 200-square-mile home range, whereas the female bears and your research bears, of whom you have 10 of them collared, have a much smaller home range, and those home ranges overlap.
Yeah, the core home ranges of the females are 3 to 8 square miles. Now, when the fall comes, if they don't have food in their core home range, they move to where food is. And so they'll end up in another female's home range where there's a surplus of food and we'll have access to feed.
And the females will share resources and allow a female from an adjacent territory that doesn't have food to come into her territory?
Yes, and that happens on a regular basis. And they all understand that. I have a study site where I watch social interactions. I'm currently a PhD candidate at Drexel University. I'll be defending my thesis in December. And at my study site, I could drive up every evening from early spring until late fall, unless I have a lecture or something to give. And I document social interactions. I provide a small food reward to any bear that shows up while I'm there. And they can tell time. They all show up at the right time. Some nights no bears show up, and some nights quite a few bears show up. But I've documented over 1,500 social interactions. And Squirty, who controls the site and controls the bears that can feed at the site, most of them are her relatives. And the next biggest population is the population of unrelated female bears from a neighboring clan that control an area of beech. Squirty controls an area of oak. So in years when there's no beech and only oak, those bears are in on Squirty's home range. And in years of, or her greater home range that she shares with daughters and granddaughters, And in years of no oak and only beech, it goes the other way.
So there's a reciprocal arrangement that enables them to cooperate and succeed, so there's enough for all.
Right. And this you know, essentially is reciprocal altruism, and which is, you know, it's a basis of human behavior. And this is the first non-human animal that this type of behavior has been described in. So it's pretty exciting. And not only do we see evidence of these relationships that are long-term relationships. I've been keeping track of this data for 23 years. So, you know, it's not like I'm looking at only 1 year or one example.
Multiple generations. You have grandmothers and daughters and granddaughter bears in this matriarchal society that you've been studying.
That's correct. And not only that, but there's all the mechanisms that go along with the reciprocal altruism. There's justice and punishment and friendship and food sharing and all these things that go along with it. And moralistic aggression, all of the mechanisms that one would expect with this type of behavior are there. And also how they communicate. They communicate both with emotion and intention. So most scientists believe that most non-human animals communicate with emotion. That is, they cry out and others hear them. But bears, on a regular basis, communicate and cooperate with unrelated individuals. So it's much more dangerous to communicate with a stranger than it is with a family member. You know, as humans, we could grunt and groan around the house and, you know, all our family would know what was up. But when you go out in the real world, you got to get it right, you know, or there's ramifications.
Right.
We humans find bears intimidating. They've got these huge claws and teeth that look like they could probably rip you to pieces. But Killam spent much of his life painting a more nuanced picture.
Bears can read our emotional communication. And the reality is, it's not that hard to understand how a bear communicates.
Imagine yourself walking on a trail. The wind is blowing through the leaves, the sun trickling through the canopy overhead. You're whistling a happy tune, and suddenly...
came across the female black bear, and her cubs were already up a tree, and she false charges you. I mean, she rushes at you, swats the ground, expels a big blast of air. Your bodily fluids begin to loosen up a little bit. She sees you as the aggressor. And all she wants to do is delay confrontation long enough for communication to take place.
You're standing there with soiled shorts. You've stopped whistling. But what's the right thing to do in this situation?
Always let the bear know that you're dominant, but you're not a threat. And you do that by talking softly, just like for appeasement sounds for talking to a pet or a young child. And bears are not out to get us. They have no interest in humans.
Bears can smell in technicolor, which is why bear sightings on the trail are so infrequent. They usually smell us coming a mile away, literally a mile away. And if not, they'll hear that whistling and they'll move out of sight before we arrive. So Ben has learned a lot about black bears in the more than 2 decades he's been working with them. But in recent years, he's begun working with a group in China on a different population of bears.
We're working on the reintroduction of captively bred panda cubs to the wild. I think we got our first cubs in probably 2014, and now we've been getting a new set of cubs each year. And our first cubs are about ready to be released.
So based on your experience with New Hampshire and Vermont black bears, you're now advising Chinese wildlife conservation interests and how to release captive-raised pandas into the wild in China.
That's correct. The goal is to end up with a bear-like a panda-like squirty that we can follow long-term with researchers in the field with the bear.
Squirty is a bear that Ben rehabbed about 10 years ago and has been one of his study bears ever since.
The problem in China is that the habitat is so dense and so rugged that there's very few observations of naturally existing pandas. Almost all the research has been done with zoo animals. And, you know, there's a wide gap between what you can learn from a zoo animal and an animal that you're with in the wild. I expect we're going to end up with some really neat stuff out of this.
Is the Chinese government on board with this program? I mean, the panda is a symbol of national pride in China, and the reintroduction of pandas into natural environments, captive-raised pandas, seems like a tremendous wildlife success story. So is the government involved in your work there?
You can't do anything in China without the government and being involved with your work. No, it's in China. There's two large captive breeding centers, Wulong, which we all hear about on the news, and there's people wearing panda suits with panda pee and panda poo on them. They've been releasing captively bred pandas for a number of years now with limited success. They've released five pandas, and three have died. Two have died from unknown empty bellies and unknown causes. One was killed by other pandas. The difference with our program is that we're going to be soft release. The researchers are establishing relationships with the cubs before they go out. We will be with them as they go out. We'll be able to see any of the problems that occur. And we'll be able, if one of the cubs is unsuitable, which is, you know, completely possible, we can bring them back in, and they won't be any worse off than they were before.
You said there were two panda research centers. You said Wulong that we hear about, and there was another one.
This one, the one I'm working out of, is the Chengdu captive breeding center, Chengdu Panda Base. And we also have, our pandas are now at a place called Panda Valley, which is their reintroduction center. Mm-hmm. And they're in an 8-acre enclosure, which was modeled after my enclosure here.
So they've been here. The Chinese have come here and looked at your program here and then gone back and replicated that and built that in China.
That's correct, except their enclosure cost $1 million to build. It has 20 cameras and indoor viewing facilities. And they were very excited when they came here. One of their concerns was that, you know, if they tried to walk a panda cub without a tether in the woods, that it would simply run off and they'd lose, you know, a very valuable animal. And when they came over here, it was the year we had 30 cubs and six were bottle feeders. And we just opened the doors and went for a walk with six cubs, and cubs were only interested in vegetation and hornet's nests, and we took them to a bear tree, and they all climbed the tree and got very excited about wild bear scent and came off and did the stiff-legged walk and marked with urine. And Hu Rong, who's the director of science and research, exclaimed, "These bears can communicate with each other without even meeting another bear," and she was very excited about it. That's one of the things that one of the difficulties I had in China. They wanted to teach the bears and teach them in captivity. And I kept telling them, I said, you got to give them an opportunity to learn. And you'll never be able to recreate the complexity of a natural situation. And the only way to do that is to get them out there where there are other animals, where there's scent, where there's especially panda scent and food and you know, that's how they learn, and get them out there early.
You can find out more about Ben Killam and his Black Bear Rehabilitation Center at benkillam.com. And watch out for next week's Something Wild, when Chris and I go for a walk in the woods to find the things hidden in plain sight. Something Wild is a joint production of the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, New Hampshire Audubon, and NHPR. For Something Wild, I'm Dave Anderson. Thank you.